Folks, thanks very much. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, helped her up. She's younger than me. I had to get up here by myself. Great to see everybody. I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group of AA in Southern Pines. Delighted to be here. My sobriety date is Groundhog Day, 1957. And thank you very much. I really appreciate Lorraine being here with 46 years, keeping me from being the oldest rat in the barn. And that's a good feeling. And so now I feel like a security blanket having somebody here. I am delighted to be here, and congratulations on a good conference. Thanks for the great work that's been done, obviously been done. This is a kind of conference that I like a great deal because it gets right down to the fundamentals of Alcoholics Anonymous, the theme of it, you know, with the steps, traditions, and the concept, very much at the heart and soul of what we're about. And I like that. I like the fact that it's been a conference with a lot of content, a lot of we had workshops or panels on just about every area of service. We missed a couple, but most areas of services had active panels going on. I had a chance to get into two of them, and they were really good. So, and it's a good, loose, warm bunch of folk. I went out kind of working the crowd a little bit while ago. I just wanted to sort of feel like who was here. Sometimes when you get up in front of one of these crowds, it looks like a bunch of enemies. You say, well, what have I done to these folk? So I like to just get out and mix it up a little bit and sort of feel at home and feel connected, and I surely do. And I'm just happy to be here. I want to tell you as much as I can of my story. I would tell it all, but I'm afraid y'all quit. I have a kind of a system I've developed in trying to talk to folks in AA. I like to quit just a few minutes before you do. You ever been talking and you just sort of see the curtain drop? You know? You keep on talking if you want to, but you're done now. So I kind of look for signs. You know, the first sign of a glaze, man, I say, whoa, let's get out of Dodge, you know. So I'll be looking for that. I'll quit. I don't care if it's mid-stroke. I mean, I'll head out for the airplane. So I am just delighted to be here, and I've appreciated very much being here and getting a good look at, I thought Chicago was made up of an airport and a hotel. That's all I'd ever seen of it. And this time I came in on Friday, and Mike put work over me and turned me over to Julia. And so I spent the afternoon Friday on the way to the hotel with a good-looking woman in her husband's convertible with his permission touring Chicago. And what a beautiful, beautiful thing. I'd never really taken the time to just kind of take a look at the things that make up this city. And I think I'm going to move up here next week. Of course, wife won't come, but I'm coming anyway, I think. So thanks for all of the courtesies and consideration. I met a lot of folks, got to see a bunch of old friends. Now I'm going to talk about drinking whiskey and stuff. I really want to talk about some stuff tonight, so I'm going to hurry. It won't sound like it to you. I'm from North Carolina, but I'm going to be going hard as I can go, and it sounds like slow motion, but it ain't. I'm a guy that I don't know. I'm no expert on anything. I'm certainly no expert on alcoholism, no expert on AA, not much anything else. If you leave here tonight any smarter than you came in, it won't be my fault. It'll be thanks to your dinner companions or something. And so what I want to do is just share with you a little bit. I want to just share one thing that I've come to believe in AA that sort of forms the foundation for what we do in AA and what I like to think about when I'm talking. I like to keep it fresh in my mind what we're dealing with here, and that's alcoholism. Alcoholism is a killer illness, absolutely a killer illness. I understand and I believe that 95% of folks who have alcoholism die of that condition, never effectively knowing that there's a way out. 95% of the people in the world die. And usually very, very much ignorant. Most folks die at a fairly early age. At 52 is the average life expectancy of a still practicing alcoholic. Interesting to me that when I came in the program all those years ago, the life expectancy was 52 years. And now with all the research and advanced training and development of stuff that we've done over the years, it's 52. We're dealing with a tough, tough illness. It doesn't yield readily. Those of us, I believe, who are fortunate enough to grab this brass ring called recovery and hang on to it are among the luckiest people on God's green earth, because it is a tremendously difficult illness. I'll join you. And it's a predatory type of an illness. It's an illness that can knock you out in a heartbeat. And it is something about it. You know, I know that when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm also acknowledging that I have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. And it isn't going to change from that. That's what it is. And the only defense that I have from the fatal nature of this illness is the practice of spiritual principles that keep my defenses in place. And all I have to do to revisit alcoholism is let up on that and let my spiritual condition deteriorate. And what at this point would seem unthinkable to me would become very normal. So it's a tough illness. I'll tell you what, just one little quick story about that, about what happens in terms of that mental obsession. It's like our book says, that the mind of a guy like me can and does turn at times irresistibly to the thought of a drink. When I first started hearing that in AA, it sounded like some pretty strong language. I didn't know how strong it was until I experienced that. First time I ever ran into a real live barking obsession, I'd been sober 3.5 years. I was very active in the program, as active as I know how to be. And I had to make a trip on a plane. Nothing radically different about that. It was a jet. I'd never been on a jet. They just invented those things, I think, or they did it while I was drunk. I didn't know a plane could fly without a propeller. Here we went. I might have been a little excited about that, but not much. You know, nothing radically different. Took off. And you know how it is, man. You don't even get leveled off where they start hustling that hooch, you know. And so that day, I was sitting near the front of the plane. They got the buggy out, and they started pushing it up the aisle, announcing what they had on it. Now, I'd heard that lots of times. But you know what I mean when I say, I heard it. I heard it. And all at once, the spiritual giant was absolutely overwhelmed with an obsession to drink. Now, I'm not talking about goofy thinking like, well, maybe you're not really an alcoholic. Maybe you overreacted and came here too quickly. No, didn't enter the mind. No goofy stuff like you're 30,000 feet in the air. Who would know? Didn't enter my mind. Or wouldn't a drink be nice? Never entered my mind. I sat there and went from spiritual giant to an absolute shivering wreck of an alcoholic. Knew I was going to drink, and fellow alcoholics, I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to drink. I knew I was going to. Took a dollar bill out of my pocket, stuck it in my shirt pocket, and I'm sitting there sweating bullets. And I thought, my God, what do you do? Well, what do you do in a situation like that? Call your sponsor? Good luck. Catch a meeting, drop by the club. I tell you what I believe you do. You're either prepared or dead meat, one or the other. Because that's alcoholism. That's the dilemma of alcoholism. What I did, I got through it, tell you that now. But what I did was what I'd heard in AA. Remember your last drunk. That helped a little. But bad memories aren't enough. Bad memories won't do it. And then I remember what folks said, when you're right up against it, you don't know what to do, pray. When I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even know the Our Father, but I'd learned to pray and believe with all my heart that the prayer would work. So I said the simplest, most profound prayer man's ever uttered. I said, God, help me. It was gone as quickly as it came. Now, that wasn't the last one, but that's the dilemma of alcoholism. It requires very little provocation. It just seems to happen sometimes. When all I have to do is let that little bit of a defense down, and here we go. So I believe that. I believe very much what John said when he finished that countdown. And I'd say it to all of us. We are dealing with a tremendously formidable illness. But thank God this program is stronger. It's stronger in every possible way. Thank you very much. Was that good? Is that good enough to get a drink of water, you reckon? Thank you very much, Jack. Thank you. I used to be very bad to drink. Now, so that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a condition, and even though it's been a long, long time, I have absolutely no illusions. I've gone to funerals of folks senior to me for whom this illness came knocking again. So I take absolutely nothing for granted. I don't know exactly why I'm an alcoholic. I think the most important thing that I know about alcoholism is the fact that I have it. I have absolutely no question in my mind, I have it. And where it came from, I couldn't care less. I've read a lot of stuff, heard a lot of stuff, all kind of theories about alcoholism. Some I like better than others. There's one that says that we tend to be alcoholic because we seem to be overly endowed with skills and abilities far beyond average people. That's a... Well, that's a nice theory, you know, that there's something about the alcoholic mind that the brain's just too big for the head, you know. And all kind of theories about that fantastic alcoholic mind. I've heard them discussed for years, but only in Alcoholics Anonymous. And ain't nobody at UI studying that incredible mind. But that's a good one. Yeah, I kind of like that. That we're just sort of creative people. We just burst and want to explode and be like Vince Goh and cut off our ear with that creative. Well, I don't know about all that. It's nice. Fact is, I don't know. I know this. I believe that I was a sitting duck for alcoholism. I was a sitting duck anyway for using alcohol more than the average cat. It's simply, I won't go into a whole bunch of causation, but what I mean when I say I was a sitting duck, I think I was a guy that was just set up so that when booze came, I didn't need to learn to use it. It just fit my life as naturally as breathing because that stuff did something for me. I was a kind of a miserable kid. I was a guy that was a study in conflict. And what I mean by that was that what you see wasn't what you got. Yeah, I was studying conflict. I was one guy on the inside, quite another on the outside. On the inside, I was a guy who was fearful, a guy who was anxious, a guy who was extremely isolated. I was not somebody who could readily connect with other people. On the outside, I looked like a loud leader type of guy that was always starting something. Wasn't that kind of guy. I was a guy who on the outside, when in my good moments, looked like a winner. On the inside, I was a loser. Because I had a remarkable ability to screw up stuff on a regular basis, no matter how good. So I was a guy who was a study in contrast. And a lot of conflict. And so when I started to drink, the magic happened for me, no mystery about it. That stuff did something important. I loved it. I would have needed examination if I had not continued to drink. Man, that stuff was wonderful. I never had anything worked as well for me as booze. Sure beats psychiatry. And was a lot cheaper. And so I just took to it. I was not an instant alcoholic, not a born alcoholic, not an alcoholic at all. I was a guy who found marvelous freedom and release and relief to the kind of uncomfortable life that I had. And I just fell in love with that way of life. Fell in love with booze. Silkworth said we drink essentially because of the effect produced by alcohol. Amen, Silkworth. That's exactly what I loved, that feeling. I loved what it did for me. And I loved the places people drank. I just loved. I've been just itching to get to that jazz. There's jazz going on somewhere in Chicago right now. And now, when I was drinking, I would have been there. That was like a magnet to me. It still is. I still want to get down there because that kind of environment. I don't know. It just sort of has a seductive quality to me. And so I just love that. I love the places. I love the people who drank. And as I just fell in that, it became a way of life to me. And I was a guy who wanted the endless party. I never wanted to quit. I was always the last guy to give it up. And I'll let you in on a little secret. As ugly as it might have looked to an observer, looked awfully good to me. And if I had been able to continue it, no matter how bad it looked, I would be doing it tonight. Now, I don't mean that I'm yearning, because I've learned you can listen to jazz sober and hear it, actually hear what's going on. So if I went or go, it'll be sober. But that thing just had that kind of a magic appeal. And so that was all it was. And the only reason I stopped drinking is because I couldn't stop drinking. I developed alcoholism. Why, I don't know. I understand that if 10 people take a drink, 9 of them go on about their business, have no appreciable difficulty with it. And they drink if they want to and don't if they don't want to. I don't understand those 9. They don't understand me, because I was the odd man out. There was something happened to me that didn't happen to other folk. I don't know why. Don't care why. I just know that it did. And something happened my 18th year where we refer to it in the program as crossing a line. You're from whatever kind of drinking, whether it's wild, celebrational, recreational, party drinking, heavy drinking, whatever, cross a line into uncontrolled drinking or alcoholism. And that's what happened to me when I was 18 years old. I had not a clue that it had happened. Had not a clue till I was sober for a good while, looked back, and then I could see that the undeniable fact was that it was as if the curtain closed on Act 1, opened on Act 2, and it was a different deal. And I had no awareness whatsoever. I don't think anything changed so much in how much I drank. I drank about as much as I could before I was alcoholic. I've been so drunk I couldn't lay on the floor, man. And you can't do much better than that, alcoholic or not. I couldn't even blink. But so nothing happened in those terms about getting drunk or even getting in moderate trouble. But the thing that happened was I got so that I could not predict how much I drank or when I would stop. Now, I didn't analyze that at the time. Never really seriously thought about that till I was sober in AA. But that clearly was my pattern, that I had no clue what would happen. I knew what I intended to happen. I intend to stop by, have a couple of drinks, loosen up, shoot some pool, go on home, do my chores, and then wind up almost invariably closing the joint and winding up in bizarre situations. I was a guy who had rather chronic difficulties with blackouts. I had a remarkable ability to wake up in strange places, often with strange people. And gets a little testy if you do that on a regular basis. I used to wake up, come to, and I wouldn't open my eyes immediately, you know, because a lot of times if you open your eyes too quick, there'll be some yo-yo standing there asking you tremendously difficult questions like, who are you? And I said, well, I'm not sure what I might have told them. You have to think about that. Or about as bad, what are you doing here? And you don't even know where you are, you know. So I got so I would wake up and not show any evidence of it, and listen for the clues. If I heard metal clanging, I knew it was okay. I have never been put in one of those places by accident. I thought it was, but I never heard anybody say, I made a mistake. Man, we shouldn't have put you in here. They always put me in. I can spot one a mile away. I don't know what he looked, but he put a policeman right on the front row. that was the kind of stuff that happened. And so that's the way my life became. And now I had absolutely no awareness of what was going on. You know, I don't know. I've never heard anybody else describe this very much, but it was certainly true with me that I don't think until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous I ever made a direct connection between the first drink and what happened. I never woke up in jail and said, geez, I should not have started drinking. Never. I've never had that, consciously had that thought. To me, when I would come to in some bizarre circumstance, my response would always be remarkably similar. It would be something like coming to, taking a look at the latest wreckage of the past, and experience what Bill wrote about. I used to think it was a little exaggerated the way he described pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization until I saw clearly what my life had become. And that's exactly what I would experience when I would wake up and there I am, failed again and on the rocks again. And so what would always follow would be that kind of moral whipping. You've done it again. You've done it again. You're no good. You're worthless. You have no responsibility. You have no discipline. You have no character. And that is, honest to God, what I believed. I did not believe it had to do with alcohol doing something different with me than it did with other people. Never remember having that thought. And then would follow the options. And some of you may have experienced some of this. I'm sure you have. Think of the options. I look at that thing. I look at this life that looks like a worthless sack of nothing. And then look at, well, what I do. First, always, but why don't you just end it? Why don't you just end it? Everybody would be better off, including you. Or if not that, why don't you just keep going? Just disappear. Just ride off into the sunset and don't bother people anymore. Just go away. Or do I suck it up and make up another bunch of lies and go back and try to start again? Pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And that was characteristic of my drinking once alcoholism started. You know, my alcoholism started it was a compact sort of a thing in a way. My serious drinking, let's see, now it's 9 o'clock and I started at 10 minutes till. That, well, that's close, you know. My alcoholism, in order to see it in a real clear panoramic view, was a short period of time, relatively speaking. I started serious drinking at 16, had what I hope and pray was my last drink 8 years later at 24. And in those ensuing 8 years between those two points, absolutely destroyed everything I ever touched. At the end of that period, I couldn't think of one human being who wouldn't have been better off if they'd never seen me, not one. Could not think of one worthy thing that I had done that I could point to with pride. Never had a job for as much as a year in my life except the Army, and I didn't want to keep that one. Every time I'd quit, they'd come get me and put me in jail, you know. Then they got tired of that game and threw me out when they wouldn't let me quit, but they threw me out with an undesirable discharge, 20-year-old guy. And so when I looked at that life, it was, I mean, I was not just somebody who had intermittent difficulties. I was a guy whose life went down the tube in a hurry. Some of us are just that kind. We tend to be basket cases from day one and get worse. And so that's what I was. And in 8 years, I went through a whole bunch of stuff with constant kinds of difficulties, jails, hospitals, psych wards, just stuff. And then I wound up just north of here, just up the lake from here. When I got thrown out of the military, I just kind of migrated up there like a wild goose or something. I didn't mean to go. I just wound up there. And so I hit my some of my roughest going in Detroit and a beautiful little resort just north of Detroit called Flint. If you haven't been, you just owe it to yourself to go one time. If you can't go there, you might try the mountains of Afghanistan. It'd be about. Well, that's where I wound up. You know, and at one point, Flint was named the worst city in the United States in which to live. And you know, when you don't have much to be proud of, you always look for something. And when I saw that rating, I felt a little sense of pride. You know. At least I made them put it on the list a little bit. I contributed to that. Well, that's just where I wound down. And so I wound up, I went up there, I started working at General Motors till my reputation got in front of me. And if anybody bought a 53 or 454 Buick, I'm sorry. I was not well at the time. But I bombed and went around there, and my reputation did get in front of me, and I wound up in Flint, Michigan, of all things, unemployed, darn near unemployable. And I wish I could tell you there was some real nice end to this story. It isn't. I wound up, I used to say that the last couple of years I lived by my wits, but that's a little bit euphemistic for what I was doing. Wits was not exactly it. I lived by my lack of character. You can hear him believe that I'm not proud of it by any stretch of the imagination, but I started to live a way of life that I honestly didn't know existed when I grew up in Mayberry down in North Carolina. Yeah, I did not know people did like that. But it's amazing what happens when you incrementally fall apart, eh? When you just sort of go a notch at a time. Because what happened every time I would hit the wall, crash, start over, I would ratchet down a notch. And what at one time would have been unthinkable became the only normal thing for me. It took me a long time when I got sober to start thinking in something less than substandard terms. Took me a long time to relate to first class. And so that's how I wound up. You know, that thing of just, I wasn't wits. I lived by using people, taking advantage of folks, hustling, bumming. In Flint, if you've ever been there, it's not really criminal activity. It's the food chain to do things that some folks call criminal. It's a case of either roll or be rolled. One or the other. Whoever's friskiest on a given day is the one that drinks. And so sometimes I was friskier and sometimes I was the frisky. But that's just the way it worked. I wasn't reared to do that. I'm not proud of that. I'm not proud of conniving and hustling and using people. I'm not proud of selling my blood $5 a throw. But that's what guys like me did. I never want to forget that period of my life when I wandered the face of this earth with no place I could comfortably call home. Don't want to forget that. Somebody mentioned today about the loneliness of this condition. God, is that ever true? That has little to do with the nearness or distance of other people. It isn't about other people. It's about an extreme isolation and an inability to connect with the world around. Living in that great pit of despair And in my early 20s, looking at myself in the mirror, I want to gag at what I saw. When the only thing I could think was, geez, you'd be better off if it were just done. Those are thrilling thoughts for a guy on the way to the party. But that's what it was. And I never want to forget that grim reality. And it would be nice if I could tell you that one fine day I had enough and called for help, somebody threw a rope, but it didn't work that way. Good many of you in here are well aware that mine was to be one of those stories that contain what I know that practically every person in this world, has, in this room for sure, has feared doing. I never met many alcoholics, particularly those who've had blackouts, or even blackouts or not, who hasn't lived in fear of doing something that couldn't be undone to somebody else. Most alcoholics don't want to hurt folk. It's hard to tell that. But deep down, most alcoholics, pretty decent folk, and don't want to hurt people. Then I was no different. I knew I was capable of anything, but I was not a predatory person. I wasn't somebody who wanted to hurt folk. And I always had a fear that I would do something horrible that couldn't be undone. And like everybody else, I was the kind of guy that would wake up in panic and go look outside if I had a car to see if it was there, to see if it's in one piece or if there's blood in it, and then breathe a sigh of relief and go do it again. And that was my life. It was just routine. And one morning I woke up in jail, no novelty there. I mean, that was a routine deal. As I woke up, the jailer came by, and I knew him quite well. And I said, hey, when can I get out? And he would normally say 10 o'clock. That day he said, I hope never. And I had not a clue what he was talking about. And then not him, but some of the other guys in there told me the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, and had run down and killed two people in a blackout, blind drunk, right down the main street. And absolutely no awareness of that then, now, or ever. But no doubt that that's what happened. You know, with a guy like me, you know, me driving down or even walking down a street was a dangerous act. Because it was like firing a loaded weapon down the street. It was just a matter of whether it hit or not. And so it... When I learned that, you know, my response was, you heard Bo describe the other side of that. My response was, it's a strange thing about the mind, it won't take in what it can't handle. And that explains a lot of behavior to me. It won't take it in if it can't handle it. And my response was just to push that away and then gradually accept the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. And then somebody contacted, one of the policemen, I think, learned that I had family in North Carolina. I don't know how. They didn't ask me. I wouldn't have told them, I don't think. I didn't want to get out of jail. It's the only time I'd ever felt that way. I was afraid to get out. I wasn't afraid to drink. I just was afraid to face anybody. I couldn't face anybody. I was deeply ashamed to be breathing when two fine young folks no longer were because of me. And so somebody learned about the family. They contacted them, told them they had a guy up there in a lot of trouble. And my folks had a mother and sister in North Carolina, and they came and got in. I didn't know how to tell them I didn't want to get out. And so they got an attorney. I was charged with manslaughter. They got me released on bond. And I knew I would never drink again. Like, my God, how could you? How could you after something like that? Anybody will tell you if it gets bad enough, you won't drink. Well, don't you believe that? If you're talking about alcoholism, the more logical question is, how would you not drink after something like that? I didn't have a clue. I just know that a day and a half later, I walked the streets and was doing whatever I could try to do to just wander. And then about the middle of the day, I started drinking from July to November of 56. I drank truly like nobody I've ever seen. And there was no mystery about what I was doing. I was doing what they call pathological drinking. You know, just I was trying to drink myself to death, and that, I mean, anybody could have seen that. And then the 19th of November of 56 was actually the date of my last drink. And I hope it was my last drink. I pray that it was my last drink. It has been so far. I finished a bottle of gin, had about that much in a bottle of gin, and I finished it, went down to court. I knew that I wouldn't be back. Had absolutely no illusions about it. Yeah. And when I went into court, my attorney, I had never heard the plea. I'd always been in the drunk line and just plead guilty to whatever they said. You know, my attorney said, there's a plea called stand mute. And I thought, my God, what an eloquent plea, eh? Stand mute. Because what else could you say? I'm not even witness. Somebody had to tell me what I'd done. And it was obvious that I had. And so that was the plea I entered. I was found guilty, of course, and sentenced to 5 to 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. Now, I knew what that meant. I was, as you gather, I wasn't a hothouse flower, but I was. I had never done any serious, I'd always been in drunk tanks or county jails or pea farms or stockades in the military, something like that. It was all just sort of lightweight, 30-day sentences or whatever. And this I knew was a different ball game. I'd been on the street with a lot of guys that were in and out of that joint. And I knew if there were guys like that in there, it was no place to be. And so when they passed that sentence, I think it was really telling to me that I had an instinctive reaction of fear. I guess anybody would. But at the same time, the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. And I'm not talking about optimism or hope or there'll be a new day. I'm talking about it's over. It's done. And now, next day I was led into that prison on a chain with five other guys, and I knew absolutely without any question I'd never come back out. I knew that. And I'm absolutely convinced, had it not been for the program that you and I celebrate tonight, I would not have walked back out. If I'd have gone in there and tried to live in that jungle with my street behavior, it'd eat me alive. I don't have any illusions about that. And so I walked into that place and didn't care. I was absolutely resigned to that fate and had absolutely no concern about walking out. All I wanted to do was disappear. I snapped back into isolation as severely as I've ever known, I didn't engage in conversation with people. I sat like a guy in a catatonic state almost. I just never engaged in any kind of dialogue with people. I just sit and read anything to keep from thinking. One day, amazing to me about how the turning point comes that starts to make. I've had many turning points. Most of them I've turned the wrong way. But I've had a lot of them in shaping the new life that have been monumentally important. And they might have seemed petty at the time. Like the thing that started the ball rolling in a new direction for me, although I had no clue about that, But one day a guy called me out for an interview that worked there, a fellow named Martin. He called me out and he did a little, I know now it was a standard social work interview with a lot of crazy questions. And I'm sure I gave him a lot of alcoholic answers and probably lied like a dog. But it's a funny thing about that. I've never had but one diagnosis in my life. It sounded different. Sometimes folks say you're a drunk or you're no good or you're a bum or you're an alcoholic or whatever. I'd heard that all my life. And from there, people would say, like, why don't you quit drinking, you know, or something like that. I never could think of a good reason to quit drinking. I mean, drunk was bad enough. Sober was unbearable. I never saw anybody that didn't drink that didn't look like they didn't drink. I mean, they just looked miserable. It looked like they were just in pain or something. And I never had any burning desire to be sober. Well, this guy made the same diagnosis. He said, man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze. Then he said something I'd never heard before. He said, we have an AA group here. I don't know if he said Alcoholics Anonymous or not, but he said, we have an AA group here. I think you ought to go. And it was just conversational like that. It wasn't putting a noose on me and dragging me and capturing me or anything like we do so often now. Just sort of say, you hungry? Go over there. They got groceries, you know. And that's about it. That's about what he said. If you got a drink, brother, they fix it. Go over there. And then I got a little note from him a few days later, about that big. He didn't want to waste paper. He got a little piece of paper about that big. Said you can start your first meeting February 2nd of 57. And now I didn't want to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a 24-year-old guy. I mean, how's a guy going to be an alcoholic at 24? I knew some, but none of them like me. I mean, I was a guy with enormous potential. I had one guy tell me that one time, and I never forgot it. I had 1,000 tell me I was about the most worthless sucker they'd ever seen. But I remember that one who said, boy, you really got something. And that's what I remembered. And so I didn't want to join AA. The only reason I believed, the only reason that I even went, was that, I don't know if you've ever been to this point or not, but I was so beaten, so absolutely beaten, that I had no fight. I just had no fight. And I think I just wandered in. They told me the Russian army, I'd have probably gone over there just about as willingly. And so I was just there. It looked like I was on Thorazine. I just kind of shuffled along, you know. And I walked in and had my name on my shirt. The guy said, Ivester. I said, yeah. He said, sit down. And I sat down and listened to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and another huge turning point. Thank God for that first meeting that I walked into. Thank God it was into a group that was well-ordered and purposeful and structured. And even though it was in a maximum custody penitentiary, it was as fine an AA group as I've ever attended in my life, including my home group right now. And thank God for that. Thank God it wasn't some little gaggle of folks sitting around talking about nothing. It was really a well-ordered, purposeful kind of a thing. And I didn't feel that day. Man, I felt like I was in a foreign land. I sat down in there, 300 people, and felt as out of place as any place I've ever been in my life. Ran much like this, read a lot of stuff. We didn't count anything. They did count us, but they didn't count how long we had. And they got through it all, the reading and stuff, introduced the speaker, and a guy, hope Chicago folk aren't offended, but this guy, it wasn't his name, but the only name he ever went by was Chi, C-H-I. And he was a guy, marvelous man. He got nicknamed Chi because he loved this city. And before he got sober, now, he'd been in that prison one time and been out for a long time. And during his criminal career, he used to come to the Windy City and do a lot of crime down here. He loved to rob stuff in Chicago. And so he was named Shy. That was the only name anybody ever called him. And he spoke that day. And he told a story, and I swear to God, I'd heard drunks tell stories, but not their own. I was sitting there shocked. I thought, what on earth would a guy come in here, look nice from far back in the room? But if you got close, he didn't look too good. He had on that blue preaching suit, and he was up there just toting that message. And I thought, my God, he was like a geek in a circus or something. I couldn't imagine why he was doing that. It just made no sense to me, to talking to 300 hairy-legged convicts about stuff like that. I wouldn't have told nobody. And now I didn't identify with him. He was as different from me as anybody I ever met. I came to love him better than Peter loved the Lord. He he became my first real sponsor. But it surely wasn't that day, I'll guarantee you that. I sat there dumbfounded at the whole deal. But I'll always be grateful for that guy, because he was one of those people that was absolutely endowed or practiced or whatever with the magic of enthusiasm. He was the most enthusiastic guy you have ever seen in your life. When he would tell his story, he was so excited you'd get excited with him. And he was just one of those people that made you feel good to be around. And there's absolutely, now there was a mystery in my mind the next week when I came back, but there isn't today. The one thing that brought me back to that next meeting was the spirit of that guy. Because I was like, it was like a magnet almost. Hey, I was sort of drawn in to that thing. Couldn't have told anybody why I was there. Nobody asked. I just walked in, sat down. For several months, I don't think I've ever felt more out of place anywhere in my life than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, 24 years old, as Lorraine can tell you, we're not coming off the production line very readily back in those days. And a 24-year-old sitting there, I was the youngest guy in the whole joint, and certainly the whole youngest one in that. Most of the guys in that group had drunk more years than I was years old. And I felt like a pure wimp there compared to some of those folks. And I didn't believe, I truly did not believe I was an alcoholic. I said I was, because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that was something else. And so they all said they were, and I said, yeah, me too. You know, but it didn't mean a thing. It was just a word. And I kept going back. I've always been a reader. I read everything we had. It wasn't much. We only had 12 publications, counting pamphlets back then. And I read all that stuff. I was a little nervous. I was first getting sober, So I read a lot of stuff. I've always been a fairly decent listener. I'd listen to people. I'd listen to discussions and all that kind of stuff. But it was always them. You know, I was like the guy watching the baseball game through a knot hole. You know, it was a big, big barrier between me and the rest of the world. But at the same time, there was stuff happening. I was starting to get impressions, starting to get feelings, starting to feel some sense of once in a while I would hear something that I guess would make sense, you know. And so there was stuff going on even though I didn't know it. And I'll tell you where another major turning point. I'm going to go fast as I can, but I ain't quite finished. In fact, I got a long way to go, but I'll get there in a hurry. The other major turning point. Yeah, I'm. When I look at that, at what formed it, what was it that took an absolutely? Well, it wasn't a guilt-ridden guy. It was a guy under a mountain of guilt. You know, when I was sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't just that I was resistant because I didn't believe I was alcoholic, or that I was too young or too smart or too much potential. I felt so unworthy that I felt ashamed to be there sucking up decent air with people that I didn't deserve. Yeah, I felt enormously ashamed to be anywhere, and particularly in some place where folks are talking about hope and help. So it was a huge, huge hurdle to get past that kind of stuff. It took a lot of stuff. And the things that really influenced that, Shy, certainly, the guy who spoke at that first meeting, my first sponsor, was a tremendous force in that. That group that I belonged to, it was an excellent group. An excellent group that did a good job of helping people understand our primary purpose. Understand that Alcoholics Anonymous is not some kind of witchcraft where fortunate few people have to get the lucky straw. Not that at all. That is where I learned I didn't know exactly what it meant, but I heard the term design for living. And that what we have here truly is a design for living. It doesn't make too much about deserving, character, motivation, sincerity. If I will do the things that are laid out in the 200 words of the Design for Living called 12 Steps, I'll have a new life. And I know that to be true. I know that. And so I'll be ever grateful for that group and for not only how they helped me to find my way into the program, but it's amazing to me about, you know, that in the Promise talks about intuitively knowing how to handle situations. I will always be amazed at that group that I belong to, 300 convicts, of how those guys would sort of sense what I needed when I needed it and nudge me or push me at the right time. Amazing to me about the sensitivity of folk in this program. And so there were a lot of things that entered in. The good feeling of belonging that started to occur when I started to get physically involved. But it as I described in the beginning, we're dealing with a tough illness. And there's a place in the book in Doc's Opinion where it says, Joe could tell you, where it talks about frothy emotional appeal not being sufficient to deal with an illness as serious as ours. And I couldn't believe that more. And frothy emotional appeal to me are those feel-good things. Like, you know, what we're doing here tonight now, in all honesty, this is kind of a frothy thing. It's a celebration where it's fundamental and it's well-grounded in things, but this is not the fundamental stuff. This is a celebration. Bo used that term. It's a celebration. We come here to sort of share with each other the good news. Hey, guys, isn't this wonderful? We'll get pumped up a little bit. Go fight some more. Those feel-good things. Fellowship is kind of a frothy thing. Activity is a frothy thing. And so I was a guy going through a lot of that kind of stuff, and I don't pan that. It's just that I don't oversell the importance of that because it got me through for a while. I'll tell you where the real deep water started to come for me. It was in, I was sort of mechanically going through the steps academically, you know, with sort of hearing the words and starting to understand what they meant. And a real turning point one day was that I was not totally ignorant of the steps. I was just ignorant of how they worked in my life because they weren't working. I went to a meeting. Guy spent the entire meeting talking about the fourth step, nothing else. He got through with it, and I went back to my cell. I said, okay, I'm going to try that. And I'd been doing a little thinking about how such a nice guy got in such a mess, and I meant to write a story about that, you know, about how such a nice fella wound up like this. And I wrote about two lines of what I had in mind. And then with no intent whatsoever, all at once, I mean, I hit the wall. The charade was over. And with absolutely no intention, two lines of what I had in mind, and with no planning, no forethought whatsoever, it was just almost one motion. I went from that and opened up and started to pour out my heart. It was not a well-defined inventory with columns and evaluation, stuff like that. But when I got through with that, I had three pages of hopeless-looking scribble nobody could read, but nobody was supposed to read that. When I got through with that, what I had just done was the most important day's work I have ever done in my life, including the next inventory, which was far more thoughtful, but it had no more value than that one. Because when I got through, I knew at a cellular level that I was alcoholic. Not the young guy, not the whiz kid, not the tragic case. I was alcoholic, absolutely no question. Our book says in one place that we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. First step in recovery. I love that word concede because that's not a public word. That's a private word. Now, I told you I was an alcoholic when I started out, and I am. That's not what that's about. That's sort of communication. You're one, I am two. Let's talk. Concede means that I accept at a cellular level that there's been a good fight, but I lost. And I accept at the core of my being that I'm a guy who can't drink. I'm not somebody who's wised up and said sober's better than that. I'm a guy who can't drink. Surrender, eh, Bo? Surrender. What a powerful experience. Personally, I know of nobody that I've ever met who's got long-term productive sobriety that hasn't experienced surrender. This program is built on surrender, not achievement or attainment. And that was a huge turning point. That day, I knew I was alcoholic. I have never doubted it to this day. That day on that plane, I had no doubts that I was alcoholic. Thank God for that. And that's the vital importance of surrender because it makes you see the long picture and not the short term. It makes you see the real consequences and not the short term relief. It helps you to understand the powerful concept of hang on. Hang on. No matter how tough it gets, I've been to days in my sobriety when it was so dark that I thought, my God, I can't take one more day. But I'm dealing with my life. I'm not dealing with social inconvenience. And that's what happened that day. Fundamental grounding that I'm alcoholic. I'm beat. That day, I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, nobody knew that. Didn't tell anybody. Didn't have to tell anybody. Didn't sign anything. This is the easiest fellowship in the world to join. If you want to join, you in if you say you are. don't have to get Bennett's approval or nothing else. You're just in. It's also easy to quit. All you got to do is quit or take a drink, whichever comes first, and then it's history. So it's that day I became a real member. And from that day to this, I have never gone to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous without knowing 100% why I was there. Not once. I don't go to bad meetings. I mean, I go to some that are trying very hard to be bad meetings, but I don't go to bad meetings. Yeah. I'm going to get a hold of somebody. We're going to have a meeting though somewhere. I don't care if it's in a corner, man. We're going to do something. So I don't go to... I've been a guy on a purpose. I'm a guy on a mission. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where I need to be for my life, not some little social club to drop in on. So that was tremendously important. And then I'll just visit Steph just a minute. Then we'll get out of jail, and then we'll start to dance here pretty quick. It's a very important point. Those first three steps are a foundation. That's about finding a relationship with a power. And then those next four, the way I like to look at them, 4 through 7, are about this whole business of understanding what I'm talking about when I say I'm an alcoholic. You know, when I got through with that fourth step, I understood that I was an alcoholic, but I also understood some other stuff, or at least started to. I started to understand something about defects of character. I started to understand something about what is it that drives my life. What is it that gives me a mind that irresistibly turns the thought of a drink? You know, what is it that makes me behave like a pure total idiot doing the same thing over and over? And defects of character are powerful propellants in this thing called life. And so I started to understand that a little bit. And in 5, I learned the true value, you know, when I admitted to another person, particularly that first person on this planet that I ever let see me ever. And what a tremendous step that was toward freedom, putting a little crack in that wall of self-centered isolation that had imprisoned me forever. And then 6 and 7, I just want to touch just a minute, because, and I'm not preaching, I sound like it, but I'm not. Just sharing. Yeah, maybe when I'm working with people, one of the things, yeah, I'm sort of concerned about where we lose people in the program who seem to be trying, who seem to be doing something. You think about that. If you're working with somebody, you're trying to get through the steps, and they seem to be conscientiously trying, and you lose them, take a look where you lose them. Take a look where you lose them. And I'm beginning to believe that it's in the area of 6 and 7. You know, that it's one thing to admit powerlessness, and it's one thing to study my navel and look at the causation and all this stuff, and it's one to examine my life. But then when we get to 6 and 7, the name of the game changes. And it becomes, for me, things like, well, do you want to get well or don't you? Do you want to do something or don't you? Do you want to be rid of these things that own you, or do you want to keep them? And it very realistically to me became decision time, where I decide if I really and truly want a new life. It's the place where I think the nature of the activity called Alcoholics Anonymous starts to change. You know, there seems to me like there was a place where, and it looks like sort of a breakthrough place, where Alcoholics Anonymous is a place to go get what I need and then get on with my life. You know, I go in there like it's the first aid station, or I go in there like it's the service station, get a tune-up, and then I get on back out and start living. If Alcoholics Anonymous never becomes a place that goes beyond that, I think it's only a matter of time till I start experiencing a little bit of AA overload, where I sit to thinking everything I hear is repetitious. Oh, I've heard that guy before. Oh, we're on that step again. You know, where I see AA as a place to go get what I need. And there's a transition that occurs where I start to be ready for a new life to appear. And I think it's in that 6 and 7 where I need to start taking this on as a way of life. I start to be a free man. And 6 and 7 are the staging area for the steps that to me have a lot to do with freedom. In fact, they have everything to do with freedom. And that 8 through 12 are the steps that have to do with restoration. They have to do with making me a free man. They have to do with letting me take my place in this world, where I identify those folk I've harmed, identify those warped and damaged relationships, and start to look at how to deal with them. My belief is this. I believe that until I go back and make right those wrongs, till I go back and mend those warped and distorted relationships, I will never be a free man. I will drag those anchors with me forever. And that's what amends are about. They're the surgery of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I start digging out those things, those behaviors, those actions that are directly tied to those defects of character. Now, that gets a little heavy, but that is truly where I think the freedom comes from. When I start understanding that defects own me, and that as I start to develop and take the actions of restoration and the steps, freedom will come. Now, you hear this said a lot, that AA is a journey, not a destination. You hear it all the time. Let me tell you that a different way. In all these years, I have never consciously solved one single problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not a one. I don't want to discourage anybody, but I've never sat in a meeting and said, "Eureka, I got it, and now I understand." Never. It's never been my experience. What I find is that there's a gradual transition that sort of occurs in 6 and 7 and moves on out and flowers in 8 and so forth, where, you know, to me, defects and shortcomings in 6 and 7, it's like defects are my actions. That's how you see what my defects look like, is by my actions. Shortcomings is what you don't see. And so I like to look at it as like two sides of a coin. Now, I've never solved one of those. I've never solved a single one. And I'll let you know a little secret. I ain't working on any of them. Because what I found literally is that when I work on them, they get worse. When I take the steps that make a difference, an amazing thing happens. I get to looking for them one day, and they go away. They go away. Let me give just a quick illustration. I keep saying quick, and I'm watching your eyes now. You're not glazed just yet. You're working on it, but I got you there yet. Let me give you one little illustration. You hear a lot of talk about relationships. I've never talked about this, I don't think. But let me just talk about it a minute. But talk about sex. That'll get your attention. How many times you hear us talking about relationships and what a horrible thing it is to work on and how we got to do all this stuff here? Now, I was a guy who always had, I didn't have particularly trouble with relationships. I had a neurotic need for relationships. I was somebody who thought he had to be connected to somebody or else my life was just nothing, you know. And so I had this absolutely obsessive need. I had to have somebody. What a tremendous freedom it was for me when I realized I didn't have to have anybody. Strange thing, when I realized I don't have to have somebody, then I can have somebody. When I got to have somebody, I run them off. Strange thing. And an amazing thing happened to me when I started looking at inventory. I won't go too far with it, but just enough to tease your imagination to think about it. You know, my mother was on the list. You know, my mother, a wonderful person. She was a big, domineering type of woman, very impressive woman, strong woman. And at the same time, she was somebody who had a real... her problem was she overdid it. She would smother me with it instead of just mother. She'd smother. And she's a wonderful person. But I was scared of her. I was angry at her. And I was fearful of her. And so I grew up in that kind of a household. And most of my life, I grew up in a household that was dominated with women. It was full of women. Well, that caused me to have just a little bit of tilt to starboard in terms of how I related to women. Because I had that kind of approach avoidance thing. You know, I loved them, but not even won't get too close. And I never had a single relationship that I didn't have an ace in the hole. You know what I mean? I never had an honest-to-God committed relationship in my life until, in fact, I married the first one I ever had, and we just finished 34 years of marriage. Yeah, but those... I don't know if she'd applaud or not. She's trying to keep up with this train. Now, we have a great time. But there's something significant to me in that, is that when I started looking at the amends to my mother, I started to recognize something. That when I grew up in that maternally dominated environment, I developed a kind of a strange, peculiar relationship to females. And my problem with females wasn't that I was oversexed or undersexed. It was that I didn't know how to have a committed relationship that had real meaning to it. And when I finally got that clear and was able to make a committed relationship, I'll tell you something, it was the most beautiful day of my life when I was able to do that. And so that's what I'm talking about. It probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But that business of dealing with defects so that I can become a free man is tremendously important. If I don't get past the point thinking it's just paying debts and apologizing, I may not get down to the cause and conditions that make me free. And so that's tremendously important surgery that occurs in those steps for me. Now, I heard Bill Wilson say one time to point to you because you're a friend of mine, his mother used to work with him. I heard him say one time that Alcoholics Anonymous is not some furtive hiding place for drunks that can go and hide out and do things in secret. That's not what Alcoholics is. Certainly it provides that. But he said the real function of Alcoholics Anonymous is to restore us to our rightful place in this world, to our rightful place in society. And how true that is. How true that is. But it doesn't happen just by not drinking. It happens by getting rid of those things that block me from freedom. What the promise is to me is that if I will do these things and take these actions, the day will come when I'll be able to walk the streets of this earth and look any person that I see in the eye. Never could do that before. Today, that's a reality for me. That I'd be able to say to anybody, including you, my life's an open book. Ask me anything you wish. Now, that's freedom, folks. That's freedom. And that's what that process is about. And that's the thing that happened. Now, that happened to me in the institution, and I started to come alive. I started to experience new life. I started to experience, you know, it's an amazing thing. In a maximum custody penitentiary with nothing that's humanizing in nature, I experienced the first freedom I ever knew in my life, the first happiness, the first pure unadulterated joy, the first feelings of self-worth, the first feelings of purpose, the first feelings of real accomplishment. Was in an environment where that shouldn't occur, but it's the power of this program. And when I talk about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean that. You know, this dude turned me on to living, and I got started living, finished 2 years at Michigan State. I didn't go to Michigan State. They sent it to me on television, but I finished 2 years. And I finally got out. They told me I could leave if I would agree to go to North Carolina. So I said, okay, I'll go. And so I did. And then I just sort of hit the ground running. I'll just talk about this one thing and then quit because people really get on my case if I don't. Now I'm as free right now as I'll ever be. But I know that a lot of people in this program sort of vacillate about whether there's real hope or whether, you know, there can really be life. I will assure you there's nobody in this room who has experienced anywhere beyond where I've been at the point of despair and hopelessness and wondering if there's a future of any kind. And so in that interest, let me just tell you that when I left the penitentiary, I left like many people. I had small dreams, nothing big. I just wanted to find a place where I could call home. I wanted to be free physically. I was free in every other way, but I wanted to be free. I wanted to be able to find a job and make a decent living. I wanted to be able to have a friend. I never knew if I ever would have one. I wanted to be a citizen of a town. That's not much to ask. I'd never been a citizen. What I did was put them on the worst city list. I never contributed anything to a community. I wanted to be part of a family. You know, the simple little things that you usually take for granted. And I'm here to tell you, dreams come true. Dreams come true. And God knows how much more. Thank God nobody let me write my ticket for what would happen. Because when I hit the ground, I just took off like a runaway train. I'm still going that way. And amazing things happened. The second week I was out, some guys asked me to go over to a prison to an AA meeting. I said, man, they're not going to let me in a prison. They may not let me out. And they said, come on. And so I went. And 2 months after I was out, here it is, 2 months after I walked out of maximum custody penitentiary, I was named outside sponsor of that place. And I just walked out of one of them. What a marvelous affirmation. About the same time, a pro supervisor came to me one day and he said, Tom, you real acumen at anything, and it worried me. I thought you were going to tell me to slow down. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't, as if he didn't know. And he said, let me check that out. And a little while later, he called me and asked me to meet him up at the Sears store where the driver's license agency was. And this story is absolutely true. Sister drove me up there. I went in, walked back. My guy was sitting there with a fellow who turned out to be the agent. We visited a while and talked. I don't know about what, but it wasn't about driving. And we just visited. When we got through, the guy handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. No test, road, written, verbal, nothing. Didn't even pay for it. That can't be legal. Yeah, I've had a lot of people tell me that I must have been well connected politically. Yeah, you bet. You bet, yeah. Sheriff and I were intimates, you can be sure of that. What I truly believe is that when God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what they are. DCM, 5 months after I was out, 2 years after I was out, I got a phone call one day from the state capitol. Asked for Mr. Iverson. I got on the phone. The guy identified himself. He'd visited the AA group I sponsored one time. And he said, "Mr. Iverson, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." Now, that had never been done with an ex-convict in history. And I, first thing I said was, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, we've checked you out." And surely they had. And I knew that that would never happen. But lo and behold, I was employed as a rehab officer in the prison system of North Carolina. And marvelous career. I went through that. And an amazing thing happens when you do good work. You start getting pushed up, you know, and I really went up further than I ever intended to. I just wanted to wrestle with the guys. I didn't want to run nothing. But there's a real hunger for leadership. And so I got kind of pushed into management. And one day, the head of our system, now I'm the first ex-con in history ever hired anything. And the guy asked me to come by that ran the system. And he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take an assignment." I said, "What?" He would normally want me to pinch hit for him somewhere. And he said, "I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." And I said, "Oh, Scott," when I got off the floor. I mean, I was even though I was in there, I mean, you know, he talking about being the man. And I didn't want to be the man. I wanted to duke it out with the guys. And I said, "Boss, I don't know about that." And I said, "Will you give me some time to think about it?" He said, "Oh, sure, take 5 minutes." And I took 5 minutes, prayed hard, and went back in and did it. And for the next 20 years, that's what I did. Headed institution. My MO wasn't an expressed thing, but I'm not a status guy, status quo type of guy. Yeah, I'm somebody. I'm a developer. I like to make things happen. I like to plow new ground. And so my MO for the next 20 years was developing new facilities, and had the opportunity to do some remarkably important things for me, and it was a great career. I stayed 39 years, and then found I was the oldest guy in the system, and I never wanted to be that. And so I finally quit. And the day I became unemployed, I was hired for no salary to be the state chair of Alcoholics Anonymous in corrections for North Carolina. So my retirement was a strange one. All I did was move from one side of the fence to the other and quit getting paid. Now I pay. And I am truly a rewarded guy. And so it's just an unbelievable thing. I sometimes, even to this day, even though I did it for 39 years, I look back and say, "Man, you couldn't have had a life like that." But it was truly something—an absolutely great career. And I'm just an average guy living in a little old town. I'm a very, very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't used to be. I still am. I'm involved in every level of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not because I'm a dedicated idiot. I've just learned that these are the things that light the fire. These are the things that fire the imagination. And for whatever it's worth, I'll just leave you with this thought. Except for Lorraine, I'm the oldest rat in this barn. And in working on my 46th year of sobriety, I'm having truly the best year I've ever had. I've never had more enthusiasm. I've never had more imagination. I've never had more fire. I've never had more creative energy in my entire life. I absolutely love what we're doing. I love the sense of doing something. And if you're not feeling that way, for God's sakes, man, lay back your ears, jump in this dude, and give it everything you got.